This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Do you find yourself searching for true crime podcasts that are different from what you're always recommended? Do you want to make a real difference in the cases that you're following? Well, you're a crime junkie, and I'm Ashley Flowers, the creator and host of the number one true crime podcast, Crime Junkie. There are hundreds of episodes already available, and each Monday we dive into the details of cases spanning from some of the most infamous to those that you have never heard covered before. Listen to Crime Junkie podcast now, wherever you're listening.
Due to the graphic nature of this killer's crimes, listener discretion is advised. This episode includes dramatizations and discussions of murder and assault that some people may find offensive. We advise extreme caution for children under 13. Now, enjoy the show. Greek mythology tells the story of Narcissus, a beautiful teenage boy who was quite taken with himself and cared very little for others. The story goes that one day a young nymph named Echo, having fallen in love with him, came calling to profess her love. Only Narcissus, not thinking she was as beautiful as himself, refused to have anything to do with her. This cruelty toward the broken-hearted nymph so angered the goddess Aphrodite that she ordered her son Eros, who most of you may know as Cupid, to shoot the young man with an arrow as he gazed upon his reflection in a pond. So deeply did Narcissus fall in love with his reflection that he refused to leave the water's edge and ultimately died there. The story of Narcissus is a warning against excessive vanity, a characteristic many serial killers have in common.
Perhaps it's no coincidence that the story of Narcissus also inspired the name of the psychiatric condition known as narcissistic personality disorder, one which includes among its recognized hallmarks a lack of empathy and willingness to take advantage of others. The subject of today's episode, John George Hay, would be what psychiatrists today might describe as a classic case. During the middle of the 20th century, while living in London, Hay murdered six people.
The Daily Mirror referred to Hay as the vampire killer because of his professed desire to drink blood. But it would ultimately be the sulfuric acid which he used to dispose of his victims that would have him forever known as the acid bath murderer. Hi, I'm Greg Polson, and welcome to Serial Killers, a new podcast diving into the minds and motives of some of the most infamous and notorious murderers. This is part one of our introspective into John George Hay, the acid bath murderer of England. If you want to listen to any episodes of Serial Killers, you can find them all in your favorite podcast directory. Don't forget to subscribe. You can also listen on our website, parcast.com, spelled parcast.com. A new episode comes out every Monday. Visit our Facebook page, Parcast, to join the conversation. As always, I'm joined by Vanessa, who will be providing insight into the psychology of serial killers. She's not a psychologist or psychiatrist herself, but has done a lot of research on the subject. John George Hay, aka the acid bath murderer, stands today as one of Britain's most notorious killers. Between 1945 and 1949, Hay claimed not only the lives of six innocent victims, but nearly every dime they had too. By his own account, Hay did so without remorse or regret. Compounding these dastardly acts further, Hay would submerge each victim in sulfuric acid, turning them into little more than sludge.
That's absolutely correct, Greg. In fact, Hay's serial killings represent only a tiny fraction of his twisted psyche. Think of it as another piece of the much larger puzzle.
Speaking of puzzles, here's one in the form of a nightmare described by Hay at his 1949 trial for the murder of Olive Duran Deacon. These words were taken directly from court transcripts and have not been altered in any way.
I saw before me a forest of crucifixes which gradually turned into trees. At first there appeared to be dew or rain dripping from the branches, but As I approached, I realized it was blood. The whole forest began to writhe, and the trees, dark and erect, to ooze blood. A man went from each tree, catching the blood. When the cup was full, he approached me. "Drink," he said, but I was unable to move.
Oof, pretty creepy stuff.
Hay described it as a recurring childhood nightmare which had haunted him his entire life. He hoped it would also convince the jury that he was insane. Now, it would seem to me, Vanessa, that anyone who would admit to murdering six people and dissolving them in acid wouldn't have to say much more to convince me they were insane. Why would Hay feel the need to talk about his nightmares?
That's a great question, Greg. In a court of law, proof of a defendant's insanity goes beyond admitting to one's crimes, however horrifying they are. Proving insanity has to do with a person's state of mind at the time the crime was committed.
I'm curious. Hay's trial occurred in 1949. Was the option of an insanity defense even around at that time?
Yes. In fact, the insanity defense originated in 1772 BC with the Code of Hammurabi. It stated that mentally ill people were non compos mentis, which in Latin directly translates to not sane or in one's right mind. This could basically excuse people from their criminal actions. Most courts around the world today use some form of the precedent set during the 1843 murder trial of Daniel McNaughton. McNaughton had attempted to assassinate no less than the Prime Minister of England, but had inadvertently killed the Prime Minister's secretary. While it was clear to both the prosecution and defense that McNaughton was insane, the three presiding judges realized there was no clear rule about how to determine whether or not someone was insane. They ultimately decided that every defendant should be presumed sane and responsible for his or her crimes unless the contrary could be proven.
McNaughton was ultimately acquitted, only a year before our killer, John George Hay, would commit his first murder. You don't think these two events could be related, do you, Vanessa?
It's hard to say for sure, but it's very possible that Hay, like nearly everyone else in England at the time, knew about the case.
As you were saying, in Hay's trial, he would need to prove either that he did not understand the nature or severity of his crime, or that he didn't understand what he was doing was immoral. Is that as difficult as it sounds?
Well, in the mid-20th century, with the exception of McNaughton, very nearly impossible. Though evolving, the study of criminal psychology was still very much in its infancy. There weren't clear definitions on what was or wasn't abnormal behavior. In courtrooms today, insanity defenses are very risky, working only about 26% of the time. Of those that are successful, 90% of the defendants were able to prove they'd been diagnosed with a mental disorder before committing the crime for which they were being tried. If Hay had spent time, for instance, in a psychiatric ward as a young man, it might have helped convince the jury he was still suffering from a mental illness when he committed his brutal killings.
Well, as far as we know, Hay never spent any time in a psychiatric hospital or with a psychotherapist before or during the time of his killings.
What we now label as mental disorders were likely considered by the public in Hay's time as manifestations of evil.
Despite confessing to killing his elderly neighbor, Mrs. Duran Deacon, and informing police where he poured her remains, John George Hay never appeared the least bit concerned about the outcome of his trial. Wearing a tailored suit, his hair slicked back, he'd simply smile and wave at the spectators lined up outside the courthouse as he arrived each day.
You've just touched on a few more hallmarks of narcissistic personality disorder. Lack of empathy toward others, in this case Mrs. Duran Deacon, arrogance, and one you didn't mention earlier, grandiosity, an unrealistic sense of superiority. In Hay's case, the attempt to appear impressive to those waiting outside the courthouse.
Great points, Vanessa. Now, why was John George Hay so sure he'd not be convicted of murdering the widow? Was it blood he was after, as the Daily Mirror claimed, or something else? And how did a well-educated, good-looking young man from a loving home become a remorseless killer? Let's find out. John George Hay was born July 24th, 1909, at Stamford in Lincolnshire, England. An only child, he was raised in the village of Outwood, Yorkshire. John's parents, Alfred and Emily, were members of a religious group called the Plymouth Brethren, an ultra-conservative sect advocating puritanical, self-disciplined lifestyles. Here's a description of Hay's childhood in his own words.
Though my parents were kind and loving, I had none of the joys or the companionship which small children usually have. From my earliest days, my recollection is of my father saying, "Do not," or "Thou shalt not." Any form of sport or light entertainment was frowned upon and regarded as not edifying. There was only and always condemnation and prohibition.
So committed were John's parents to protecting themselves and their son from the perceived evils of the outside world, John's father, a coal mining engineer, erected an approximately 10-foot-high fence around their home and garden.
I can only imagine that fence had an enormous impact on Hay's perceptions of the world.
How so?
Well, not only would it have appeared 100 feet high to a young boy, it would have told him in no uncertain terms that the society beyond the fence was dangerous and not to be trusted. A message likely also conveyed to neighbors who might have taken offense at the implication Hay's family wanted nothing to do with them. Whenever they would see the family outside, neighbors probably stayed clear, intensifying John's feelings of isolation.
In fact, in those early years, John had almost no contact with other children outside of his small weekly church group. Hay's parents despised their non-brethren neighbors, who they considered sinners and inferior to themselves in the eyes of God. They would teach their son to do the same. Once, when John's father learned John's class was reading Treasure Island, he confronted the teacher, saying a book about murder and pirates was unfit for children.
Quite a number of other serial killers, before and after Hay, shared in common authoritarian parents. Generally speaking, authoritarian parents demand adherence to excessive conformity and rigidity, orientation toward security and stability, and intolerance and arrogance toward people who don't share their lifestyle. Which exactly describes what we know about Hay's parents. Distilled further, authoritarian households generally demand children speak only when spoken to and behave only as they are told. Children who fail to abide the rules of an authoritarian parent are also usually punished severely. This has a negative impact on the children. For instance, kids exposed to authoritarian parenting show less advanced moral reasoning and self-regulation. They might also be especially reluctant to confess wrongdoing to authority figures. A Dutch study found kids with authoritarian parents were rated as less helpful and less popular by their teachers and classmates. They were also rated as less mature in their reasoning about moral issues and less self-reliant. In adolescence, a study in Cyprus showed children from authoritarian homes were more likely to have experienced bullying, both as victims and perpetrators.
After all that, it should come as no surprise that several students who attended Queen Elizabeth Grammar School, Wakefield, with Hay, characterized him as very strange and even a bully. I have a feeling as we continue, we're likely to touch on even more.
Bullying is an excellent example of the kind of behavior children and adults engage in when they don't have the tools or personal skills to connect with other people.
What type of personal skills do you mean?
Well, the kind of skills young children learn from being around each other. How to share or take turns, make friends, work and play well with others, respect non-authority figures, compromise and cooperate with each other. Hay's parents' refusal to allow him to play with other children would have deprived him of these critical early lessons. It's no surprise Hay would have engaged in bullying. A classic example is the boy pulling the hair of a girl he likes at school. If that boy didn't learn how to communicate verbally with other kids, he would likely express his feelings physically.
That's very interesting, Vanessa. Perhaps we'll see more of that as Hay enrolls in Wakefield Cathedral School around the age of 10. But first, let's take a quick break.
And now, back to serial killers.
When we left off, 10-year-old Hay had enrolled at Wakefield Cathedral School. A very smart young man, Hay attended on an academic scholarship. He would get up at 5 in the morning and walk 3 miles to attend. It's important to note that Hay's new school was overseen by the Church of England, which had its own rules about how to worship God. Rules which often did not coincide with those of the Plymouth Brethren in which he grew up. Hay described the challenges of being caught between two religions.
There was considerable conflict of thought during this period. The views of my cathedral teachers were being constantly fought out with those of the brethren. My father had always impressed me with his indisputable knowledge of being right. But the disquieting thing was that it appeared possible to produce two equally satisfactory interpretations of the same text. Which one was right?
Hay went on to say he found himself impressed and fascinated by the ceremonial aspects of worship at the cathedral, like candle lighting and displays of the crucifix, which the Plymouth Brethren expressly forbade in its services. Despite his challenges, Hay did manage to finish school. He then accepted an apprenticeship at a firm of motor engineers. A little more than a year later, though, he left the engineering firm, taking up a series of jobs, including work in insurance and advertising. But at the age of 21, he was suspected of stealing cash from an employer and was quickly fired. It's believed he avoided charges because his father paid up.
While it's not uncommon for a young man to try different jobs until he finds one that suits him, stealing from an employer is not a promising start and clearly suggests criminal tendencies.
John did not drink or smoke, which was unusual for a young man at this time. He was, however, described by those who knew him as very interested in girls and sex. Around this time, Hay is even named as a defendant in a divorce case, accused of having an affair with a married woman. Lucky for Hay, the case was dismissed. In 1933, Hay would find a job as a salesman dealing in motor insurance, though as you might suspect, it doesn't last very long. Hay's co-workers described him like this.
He was unusual, but there was nothing on which anyone could put an actual finger on. But he was good at his job, very confident and self-assured, so he was slightly better paid than his peers. We all found him charming, and so did our connections.
He told us very little about himself or his home life. He was extremely reticent. That aside, he could also be very friendly and easy to talk to.
Hay was ambitious and very much concerned with the image he projected to others. It's likely he wished to do better than his parents had.
You've touched on another trait of the narcissistic personality disorder, dreams and fantasies of success.
Well, why would dreaming of success be a part of the disorder, Vanessa? Aren't we actually taught that it's a good thing?
It absolutely can be. However, there are times when it's not. For instance, in Hay's case, while he may have had fantasies and dreams about success, he often didn't actually work constructively toward them. Instead, he expected things to just happen because either he said them or because he felt he was special. When his dreams didn't magically come true, he would become angry and resentful and start looking for ways to take what he wanted.
Speaking of which, Hay developed a fascination with fast cars at this time. Cars he couldn't afford on his meager salary, but somehow still managed to buy.
When I first discovered there were easier ways to make a living than to work long hours in an office, I did not ask myself whether I was doing right or wrong. That seemed to me to be irrelevant. I merely said, this is what I wish to do. And as the means lay within my power, that was what I decided. If you are going to go wrong in a big way, like me. Go after women, rich old women who like a bit of flattery. That's your market, if you are after the big money.
Case in point. Hay was determined to see his dreams realized, no matter what the cost to those around him or the risk of imprisonment.
In 1934, while maintaining the appearance of a businessman, Hay engaged in all manner of scams and swindles. He also met and married an attractive young woman named Beatrice Hamer. Beatrice would later state that she was the prettiest girl out of a large, poor family. She described her first encounter with John like this.
We met accidentally on the street. Hello, how are you? He said. I want nothing to do with you, I replied.
Beatrice's sister would recall Beatrice talking about breaking the engagement, but was persuaded not to. She said, oh God, I wish it could be anybody else. When she asked about whether her fiancé had money, she said, he has, but I don't know where he gets it. We've already heard that Hay was a very charming man. It's likely he simply persisted and eventually wore Beatrice down, basically overpowering her reluctance. In marriage records, Hay described himself as a company director, though he was actually a car salesman. The Alexander Hotel was given as their address, which is not an atypical living arrangement for singles or young couples without much money. Hay would mention later to a prison doctor that he married not for love, but because his rigid home life had become more than he could stand, and this is the only means of escaping with his parents' blessing. In England in the 1930s, it was common for children to live at home until marriage. It's likely Beatrice's family situation played a part for her as well. Whatever honeymoon John and Beatrice were enjoying would not last long, however.
Police, open up!
It was only 2 months after we had been married that 3 policemen called. John went away with them. I did not know then what it was all about. I followed them down to Leeds Police Station and then saw John behind bars.
Beatrice would soon learn that John had been arrested for fraud. He was accused of forging documents to get loans for cars which were never purchased. Hay was tried with two accomplices. On December 4, 1934, John and his co-defendants, with indisputable evidence against them, pled guilty. Hay was sentenced to 18 months. This marked the first and last time he'd work with others.
It's interesting to note that despite Hay's brush again with the law, his parents continued to believe in their son's redemption. They sent flowers and letters of encouragement to him in jail. They also looked after Beatrice, who discovered after John's arrest that she was pregnant. All of this, of course, supporting Hay's claim that his parents, however strict, were supportive and loving toward him.
In May of that year, with John still in prison, Beatrice gave birth to a baby girl. Convinced against starting a family with a man she now knew to be a criminal, on top of the fact that John was offering her no financial support, Beatrice left the Hay family home. She gave up her and John's daughter for adoption a few months before his release. There's no evidence to suggest John ever made an attempt to meet or contact his daughter. He may be even denied paternity. Here's Hay in his own words describing that period.
After my release, my only focus was getting work, and efforts were made to set me up in a dry cleaning business with a partner. The shop cleaned over 2,000 garments a week from the first day. I was optimistic and had ideas for improving the system, which would have left competition streets behind. But luck was against me. My partner was killed in a motor accident in Ashdown Forest, and his wife wanted out of the business.
Another account states that Hay was dismissed because he was asking for and taking bribes from people approaching the company for employment.
It's important to remember that Hay gave these interviews before, during, and soon after his trial. He would have been compelled to tell a story which best suited his needs, perhaps to encourage readers to see him in a more sympathetic light.
That's an excellent point. In December of 1936, Hay traveled to Glasgow and then ended up in London. Life in London would be very different for a man whose life had been mostly limited to small towns like Yorkshire. Quite possibly, he moved hoping to begin his life again in a place where he and his criminal record were unknown.
A capital city with millions of people who have no knowledge of his past? For a man who was making his living defrauding others out of theirs, this must have seemed like a very big pool from which to choose victims.
At least initially, Hay found employment by a young man named William McSwan, who operated the Walham Green Amusement Arcade. He employed Hay from February to May 1937, and then again at an arcade in Shepherd's Bush. Hay persuaded McSwan to install jukeboxes and employ attractive girls to encourage young men to spend their money there. The two got along very well, and often went out on the town in McSwan's car. Hay even met McSwan's parents, and when John's mother visited him in London, he introduced them to each other.
It might be a good time to examine for a minute another pattern which has emerged in Hay's life, one which we've seen in many other serial killers. Hay understands the importance of appearing respectable. A job provides an excellent cover for someone also engaged in criminal activity. You mentioned earlier, Greg, that before Hay's last prison term, he owned cars which cost more than he could afford. While this raised suspicion with some coworkers, the fact that he did have a job at least made possible the explanation that maybe he'd taken out a loan or was being frugal in other ways.
Without a job, I'm guessing people would have been more suspicious. So that makes a lot of sense.
A job suggests the person is reliable and trustworthy.
Mm-hmm.
A job plays on the prejudice that crimes are primarily committed by derelicts. Famed serial killer and known cannibal Jeffrey Dahmer worked during the day for a chocolate factory. Child killer John Wayne Gacy was a manager at a Kentucky Fried Chicken and a part-time clown at kids' birthday parties. Ted Bundy bagged groceries, sold shoes, cleaned tables at a restaurant, and volunteered for political campaigns.
During this time, Hay would attempt his most ambitious crime to date. While living in a flat at Hammersmith, he started teaching himself law. Not because he wanted to be a lawyer, but because he wanted people to believe he was a lawyer. He composed hundreds of letters posing as a lawyer, which he mailed to shareholders of various companies. In the letters, he presented himself as working for the company in which they already owned shares, writing to offer them even more stock at a deep discount. Though only a few replied, it was enough for Hay to make enough to live on for a few months. That is until one of the people he mailed a letter to decided to visit Hay in person. But the man became suspicious of Hay and the operation, so he contacted police. At his trial, Hay claimed he was merely working for a clerk for another man and that he believed was operating a legitimate business.
Attempting to shift the blame to a vague and usually mysterious accomplice is not uncommon among criminals.
And the judge didn't buy his story either. He told Hay that he had no excuse for committing a well-planned series of frauds. But believing Hay might still be young enough to learn from his lessons, the judge gave John just 4 years instead of the maximum of 20. Hay would have this to say about his conviction.
To me, forgery was a battle of wits, a game of skill, and there is no doubt I am good at both forgery and fraud. As a boy, I was punished for everything, right or wrong, or what pleased or displeased the Lord. I took a poor view of this. To break the rules was, to me, part of the game, and to be punished was the same. By now, I had completely broken from their approach to life. I was now diametrically opposed to that view.
Hay clearly looked at his actions and consequences as a game. This is very similar to the way other serial killers describe their crimes, matter-of-factly. We can check off a few more of the traits of narcissistic personality disorder here. Hay expresses no concern or consideration for the victims of his frauds, which matches with lack of empathy and willingness to exploit others. Another is entitlement. Hay believes that because he's smarter than the people he swindled, they got what they deserved.
Well, that definitely sounds like our guy. Hay would remain in prison this time for just under 3 years. It was stated that upon entering, he was 28 years old, with dark brown hair, and was 5'7" tall. He interestingly stated his religion as Church of England. According to a prison chaplain, Hay made full use of the prison library and read books about physics, chemistry, and the law. Perhaps of greatest interest was a statement of Charles Morgan, a former cellmate of Hay's who recalled when interviewed during Hay's trial in 1949 a particular conversation the two men had almost 10 years earlier. We'll eavesdrop on that conversation, but first, we want to thank our sponsors.
And now, back to our story.
As I was saying before the break, Hay's cellmate, Charles Morgan, recalled a particularly notable conversation the pair had in prison.
Hey, Charlie.
Charlie, it's lights out, man. Keep your voice down.
Who could tell that a murder had been done if a person completely disappeared?
What do you mean, disappeared?
I mean gone, forever, banished.
You mean buried?
No.
What then?
You ever seen what acid will do to a mouse?
I've seen what the keeper will do to a fella talking when he isn't supposed to.
It makes it disappear.
I guess if the fella did it himself and he kept his mouth shut, he'd be safe.
Yeah, that's what I figure too.
We should keep in mind that it's not unusual for prisoners to exaggerate or even lie about interactions they had with other prisoners who become famous for one reason or another. Sometimes stories are told in hopes of making a deal for a reduced sentence, and sometimes just simply to break up the monotony of prison life. It could also have happened just as he said. Another man who knew Hay in prison recalled Hay talking about the disposal of bodies by acid. And apparently he said that without a body, they could never do anything about a murder. Therefore, he always maintained that it would be a case of corpus delicti. Vanessa, would you mind telling our listeners what Hay was referring to?
Corpus delicti is a legal principle which, translated from Latin, means body of evidence. In the case against an accused arsonist, it would refer to the charred remains of a house. In other cases, it can mean a physical object upon which the crime was committed, such as a person or dead body. It would appear Hay was suggesting that without a body, a person, perhaps even himself, could not be convicted of murder.
While Hay was still in prison in 1939, Great Britain declared war on Germany and officially entered World War II. When Hay was released in 1940, he discovered a country under near constant attack from the German bombing raids. After securing a place to live, Hay took a job as a fire watcher in the small central London district of Victoria. He was responsible for keeping an eye on the rooftops of buildings in case smaller fires started during or after bombing attacks. He would put them out when he could, or call for help when he couldn't. While it may be tempting to think Hay may have turned a corner in prison, or that he cared about the homes and businesses he was helping to protect, neither was true. In fact, in this journal entry, Hay describes an entirely different perspective about fires that you might assume from someone whose job it is to put them out.
I love fires. I remember the fires during the war. I always thought it a pity they had to be put out. They always fascinated me.
Vanessa, refresh my memory. How common is it for serial killers to have a fascination with fires?
fairly common. Fires represent a powerful and destructive force. Perhaps Hay and other killers see it as a representation of how they feel or what they aspire to be. David Berkowitz, known as the Son of Sam, was so infatuated with starting fires as a child, other children called him Pyro. He's believed to have started over 1,400 of them.
The war made one stop and think of the general conception of things. That there was an all-loving God could not very well be reconciled with all that was going on to innocent people. I loathe suffering. I detest to see humans in pain or fear, and I was shocked in both mind and spirit. The ghastly sights after two landmines had wiped out a block of buildings are fixed indelibly in my memory.
Here Hay seems to contradict the serial killer convention of lacking empathy. What could this statement be about?
On one hand, it might have been another attempt to humanize himself to the public, play up the story that he was somehow a victim. On another, Hay may have, in witnessing the death and destruction of the war, made the final leap his imagination needed to justify the deeds which were to come. Or both of these statements could be true.
The destruction being leveled against England at the time did nothing to temper Hay's criminal tendencies, and indeed may have provided a distraction for his crimes. In May of 1941, however, he was in court again on charges of stealing. Hay pleaded guilty on two of the charges and was found guilty on a third. He would be sentenced again to hard labor, this time for 21 months. Vanessa, how common is it for serial killers to dabble in other crimes before turning ultimately to murder?
Well, very common. As I mentioned before, it's likely that Hay had narcissistic personality disorder. This means he didn't see the things he was doing as necessarily wrong or immoral. People with this disorder tend to make decisions based on what they want and need, without considering what effect those decisions might have on others. After his break from his Plymouth Brethren teachings and later Anglicanism, there wasn't anything, ideologically speaking, standing in his way. If he needed or wanted something, he simply found a way to get it.
Hay would call the prison at Lincoln the worst he ever knew. He dismissed his fellow prisoners as a bunch of cheap crooks and would later write,
"I made up my mind that after this, there would be no more inside for me."
Returning south, Hay would briefly gain employment at a light engineering firm named Union Road Tool and Garage Company. He was employed by Alan Stevens, who trusted Hay enough to rent him a room in his home. What Stevens likely didn't expect was that his 16-year-old daughter, Barbara, would fall in love with the 34-year-old Hay. Barbara once said of Hay,
"He was like a film star. Very neat and nice in appearance. Always well-dressed and always cheerful. Just the same in the morning as he was in the evening. He does everything in moderation. He smokes a little, he drinks a little, and the big passion of his life is food. He loved good food. He is a brilliant pianist and loves everything good in music and entertainment. He gave me lots of gramophone records and all good stuff. We went to the ballet together and to other first-class shows. I knew he was married. I was not sure whether he was divorced or only separated. I hoped that that would all be cleared up."
By this time, however, whatever interest Hay had in sex during his early 20s was long gone. Hay offered some thoughts on this.
"What do I think about sex? The answer is quite simple. It should not exist. Propagation should be an insensible act, like throwing off of acorns by an oak tree. Human nature is a nuisance and fills me with disgust."
Hay's brief job with Stevens would be his last legitimate employment. After a decade in and out of prison, a failed marriage to Beatrice, his religion abandoned, at the ripe old age of 35, Hay had no steady job, few financial assets, and no social position. From then on, he decided he would become a professional criminal, and unlike most serial killers, give up his day job. In desperate need of money to hold him over until he could get his schemes working again, Hay turned his attention to getting reacquainted with his former employer and friend, arcade owner William McSwan.
If I remember correctly, Hay worked briefly for McSwan in 1937 at an arcade, and by most accounts, Hay and young William McSwan were good friends.
Yes, that's right, Vanessa. And over the years Hay recently spent in prison, they kept in touch by letters and even a few times when McSwan came to visit. All of which makes Hay choosing him as his first murder victim all the more shocking. In August 1944, Hay rented three rooms in the basement of 79 Gloucester Road. On September 7th, he placed an order over the telephone for 6 pounds of muriatic acid and 2 10-gallon containers of sulfuric acid. The following is the only account of the murder of William Donald McSwan given to the police by Hay in 1949.
On September 6, 1944, William, whose address at that particular time I can't remember, met me at the Goat Public House, Kensington High Street, and from there we went to number 79 Gloucester Road, where in the basement, which I had rented, I hit him on the head with a pipe.
He was dead within 5 minutes or so.
I took his watch and odds and ends, including an identity card, before putting him into the tank. Eventually, I stood up and was appalled by the presence of a corpse on my hands, but experienced no sense of remorse. I left the question of dealing with the corpse until the following day and went home to bed. I awoke and contemplated the action I had taken. I wondered how it was possible for me to have done something from which normally I should shrink. I returned to the basement and then realized I must do something about the body. The question of disposal did not arise until after the event. Then the method appeared obvious. When I returned to the basement the day after, I had to first find a drum in which to place the body. I discovered one which had been in use as a water butt in a churchyard. I put McSwan into the drum and then proceeded to fill it with acid. I had not thought to prepare for the fumes. I was badly choked. I had to keep going out for fresh air. Eventually the job was done and I left the basement, locking the door behind me. Subsequently, I returned to find the operation completely successful, and when the body disappeared, I poured the sludge down the drain. If anything like teeth remained, they will now be down Barking Creek or wherever it is the sewers of London flow into the sea. I experienced no remorse after the killing.
One of the most interesting parts of this account to me is that Hay and McSwan were friends. Generally speaking, most of the victims of serial killers are not well known to them. It is a rare killer indeed that can share meals with you, meet your parents, enjoy nights on the town, then turn around and murder you, go home and fall asleep. By that description, it makes you wonder, who can you trust, really? Perhaps as terrifying as the acid baths Hay used to dissolve his victims is the idea that no matter how well you think you know someone, you could actually be completely wrong.
A terrifying thought indeed. Next week, we'll hear about 5 more murders committed by John George Hay, including one in which his victim's dentures were used to identify her after nearly everything else had disappeared.
Also, in an ironic twist, we'll learn of a business opportunity which could have made Hay the multimillionaire he had always dreamed of becoming, if only he hadn't been so impatient with his final victim, the widow, Mrs. Durand Deacon. All that and more next week as we continue our look into the mind of John George Hay, the acid bath murderer.
Don't forget to subscribe to Serial Killers on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, or any other podcast directory. Or through our website, parcast.com. That's parcast.com. A new episode of Serial Killers comes out every Monday. Please let us know what you think and join the conversation on our Parcast Facebook page. You can tweet us at Parcast Network. That's P-A-R-C-A-S-T Network. As always, we thank you for listening. Have a killer week.
Serial Killers was created by Max Cutler and developed by Ron Cutler. It is a production of Cutler Media and is a part of the Parcast Network. It is produced by Max and Ron Cutler, sound designed by Ron Shapiro, with production assistance by Joel Stein and Maggie Admire. Serial Killers is written by Scott Wilson and stars Greg Polson and Vanessa Richardson. The amazing cast of voice actors includes, by alphabetical order, Mike Capozzi, Kinna McEnroe, and Steve Pinto.